For just a second, I'll qualify the witness. Degrees from Franklin and Marshall College and graduate degree from School for Advanced International Studies in Washington. But the qualification is much more extensive than that. It involves a leadership of a center which, under his tutelage, became one of the leading centers for international relations research, the Henry L. Stimson Center in Washington, serving for 11 years, and then stepping down so that he could spend a little bit more time on writing and other projects. And one project has been to continue the direction of a program he's headed in South Asia, nuclear arms control and threat, more recently threat reduction, as well as the Kashmir struggle. And earlier than that, he spent 3 years in the Carter administration in the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, directing their activities on defense policy and in toward the end, threat reduction there. He worked with several people on Capitol Hill as legislative assistants to two members of Congress, Norman Dick and Floyd V. Hicks, one in the Appropriations Committee and the other in the Armed Services Committee. But more relevant to his qualifications, one of two things most relevant. One is a feel for this emerging problem that began, I remember when I first met him, when he was trying to do an objective study of the Vietnam War, and the organization with which I was affiliated at that time, which had not made grants for that purpose, said this was unique, and we did fund his study. But then, in our own time, a lot of other books. Strategic Stalemate, Arms Control in the Reagan Administration, Verification and Compliance, Commercial Observation Satellites, Crisis Prevention, Confidence Building and in South Asia, Global Confidence Building, Cooperative Threat Reduction, so on, and articles that match that contribution in all the leading newspapers. And now a book, Cooperative Threat Reduction, Missile Defense, and the Nuclear Future. How could he have known that what we've been witnessing in the last few days was the paramount problem that, perhaps opportunity that rests before us. So it's a great pleasure to introduce somebody who has lived with this problem when some of the rest of us were not sure this was the problem and set it aside perhaps too long. But now we have an opportunity to hear him this morning on his reflections on the cooperative threat reduction and the other items in the title of his book. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Crepon.
Thank you very much, Ken. I want to talk to you about nuclear nightmares, and I'm going to give you a very brief historical run-up to where we are now, because I think it'll help us think through what we need to do. All of our presidents have had nuclear nightmares. President Truman had one heck of a nightmare. He was facing a deeply disturbed leader of a communist state who was a mass murderer on the scale of Adolf Hitler, and he had the bomb. And we worried about what he would do with the bomb. And soon after demonstrating to the world that he had the bomb, we found ourselves in a war on the Korean Peninsula. And if that wasn't worrying enough, we weren't sure if this war on the Korean Peninsula was simply a prelude to something even worse. It might have been a feint by Stalin and by his cohorts in communist China and North Korea. We weren't sure what Stalin was up to. What did President Truman do? What instruments did he use to deal with this terrible nightmare scenario? Well, he discounted one instrument. He discounted the instrument of preventive war. There was consideration in strategic circles back then about maybe taking out the Soviet nuclear arsenal before it could grow and spread within the country. But this was rejected by the Truman administration and by most strategic thinkers of the day. We were, after all, the victims of a preemptive strike not too much earlier at Pearl Harbor. And that was not something that we did. That was something that the Japanese did. And there were other kinds of problems. Back then, we weren't sure where to find this stuff. And if we could find it, remember, this was the time before we were watching things from the sky, from space, and we really didn't have that many aircraft crisscrossing the Soviet Union to take pictures. Even if we were able to find it, we were pretty sure that the Soviet Union would reconstitute its nuclear capability, its nightmare capability, and put it in ways where we couldn't find it. So President Truman and his successors used two instruments to deal with this nightmare. One was nuclear deterrence, and the other was containment. Fast forward to President John F. Kennedy. He had a nightmare too. His nightmare was different. His nightmare was that someday, perhaps one of his successors would find himself in the Oval Office in a world in which maybe there would be 20 countries that had nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction. And this was a pretty severe nightmare because President Kennedy and the people around him and those who followed thought that in a world in which 20 countries had the bomb, there was a much greater likelihood that it would be used on the battlefield. And if nuclear weapons were used on the battlefield, somewhere far away, in some localized dispute, then the barn door would be open and nuclear weapons might be considered just another instrument of warfare. And we didn't want that to happen because we viewed the use of nuclear weapons in war as something that would just be devastating to our national security. So President Kennedy and subsequent presidents worked real hard to prevent this nightmare from occurring. And they used a number of instruments to try and prevent the nightmare from occurring. One instrument was the establishment of norms, trying very hard to set standards, global standards, against the acquisition of these very dangerous weapons and against their use. And every year that transpired in which nuclear weapons were not used, and American presidents were faced with some pretty tough decisions about whether or not to use nuclear weapons in Korea, in Vietnam, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, over Berlin. We had lots of dilemmas in which we could have broken the norm against using nuclear weapons. But successive presidents resisted that impulse and tried to establish the norm, not to use, not to acquire. How do you strengthen norms? A very important instrument that President Kennedy and his successors relied upon was treaties. Treaties that codified these norms of proper international behavior. And some of the treaties dealt with nuclear testing. Some of the treaties dealt with superpower relations and how they treated nuclear weapons. Probably the most important treaty, at least with respect to the nuclear danger, was the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was negotiated by President Kennedy's successor, and it was sent to the Senate for its consent to ratification by President Johnson's successor, President Nixon. This treaty is in force. It establishes a norm against proliferation, against acquisition. About 180-plus countries now have signed up to this treaty. Other treaties were negotiated dealing with chemical weapons and biological weapons, other weapons of mass destruction. So we have norms, we have treaties. What other instruments were used? Well, the instruments of deterrence and containment were still very applicable to this nightmare of global proliferation. We wanted to make sure that any country that tried to acquire these weapons or that used them could expect unacceptable damage, nuclear deterrence. We maintained very strong conventional forces. We needed to show to our friends and allies that we would be there to help them, that we would offer them a security umbrella so that they wouldn't have to themselves acquire nuclear weapons or other weapons of mass destruction. So very strong alliances were key to preventing this nuclear nightmare during the Cold War. We tried to establish export control regimes. So we gathered like-minded countries to try and agree on things that we would not ship to countries that were interested in acquiring these weapons of mass destruction. We developed a cooperative partnership with the Soviet Union against proliferation. Sworn ideological foes during the Cold War, we agreed on this, that we would work together to prevent proliferation. Soviet Union was a good partner for us. They kept very tight controls over their own massive stockpiles of dangerous weapons, and they didn't share them with anybody else. They didn't share them with their friends abroad, and they didn't share them with their Warsaw Pact allies. They kept them under tight control. These weapons, when they did move outside of the Soviet Union, they moved with the Soviet, with the Red Army. They didn't go anywhere else. We relied very heavily on the instrument of diplomacy during the Cold War to prevent this nightmare from occurring. Preventive diplomacy, not preventive war. And there were occasions when countries thought very seriously about acquiring nuclear weapons. We thought it was a bad idea. We found out about it in advance, and we persuaded these countries not to go there. Countries like South Korea, Taiwan, other countries contemplated getting the nuclear option and decided against it. Believe it or not, Sweden, Argentina, Brazil. There was regime change in South Africa. And the outgoing apartheid regime decided that it was going to disestablish a very small nuclear arsenal that it acquired. That was very good news. After the Soviet Union dissolved, three countries found themselves instant inheritors of serious nuclear arsenals. And we worked very hard diplomatically to persuade Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan to give them up voluntarily. Preventive diplomacy was a very important instrument in preventing this nightmare from occurring. We relied on multilateral organizations to help prevent this nightmare. We worked with the United Nations. We worked with the international organizations that were created to help prevent proliferation. One of them involved a group of international inspectors based in Vienna that would go and see that power plants, nuclear power plants, that are permitted, anyone can get them, are not being misapplied to create nuclear arsenals. So that was the nightmare during the Cold War, and these were the instruments that were used to try and prevent it. 20 states did not acquire nuclear weapons during the Cold War. We did pretty well. In addition to the five nuclear powers, Israel acquired a covert nuclear arsenal. That was troubling, especially to many countries in the Middle East that feared Israeli power projection. But we managed to hold the line elsewhere in the Middle East. Two countries, two very important holdouts in South Asia. But proliferation on the subcontinent, bad as it was, which was demonstrated in 1998 when both India and Pakistan tested these weapons, didn't spread. Didn't spread to Nepal, didn't spread to Sikkim, didn't spread to Sri Lanka. Kind of contained. Bad news, very problematic, but it seemed to be contained. Fast forward to President George W. Bush. He has a different nuclear nightmare. And his nuclear nightmare is evildoers who are equipped with weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. These evildoers can be national leaders. They can be terrorists. They can be terrorists in collusion with national leaders. This problem, this nightmare, has been accentuated by the end of the Cold War because Russia is a very different place than the Soviet Union. And these huge stockpiles of dangerous weapons are sometimes hard to safeguard. The problem of loose nukes is something that we have to worry seriously about. Fissile material, a very shortcut route to acquiring nuclear weapons. The institutions that previous presidents had worked so hard to shore up to prevent their nuclear nightmare don't really work so well in the post-Cold War world. These treaties and these institutions were not designed for the kinds of problems that we're now facing. So what to do? President Bush and his key advisors don't really talk very much about norms. They don't talk about norms, they talk about evildoers. And the issue of whether there ought to be a norm against proliferation is subtly changing. And now we're seeing discussions of proliferation described in very different ways. There are good guys and there are bad guys. We don't care so much about good guys getting weapons of mass destruction because they don't constitute a threat. We do care a lot about bad guys getting weapons of mass destruction. We don't hear that much about strengthening treaties as a means to strengthen norms. The war that is now underway in Iraq is not being waged to strengthen treaties. It's being waged to disarm an evildoer. These treaties are widely viewed as feckless, as being not very helpful in dealing with the core problem of proliferation or terrorism, because the bad guys either don't belong to the treaties, or if they do belong to the treaties, they are cheating under the very relaxed rules that the treaties allow. We don't hear very much about nuclear deterrence, certainly not in the context of dealing with proliferation. Quite the opposite. Nuclear deterrence, this instrument that was used for previous nightmares, doesn't work against someone who is intent on mass death, someone who plays by very different rules than we in the Soviet Union played by during the Cold War. We are having great difficulty now in working with major powers, with the exception of Great Britain, in dealing with the proliferation nightmare, the new proliferation nightmare. Great powers seem to be more interested, again, with the exception, the important exception of Great Britain. Great powers now seem to be more interested in war avoidance, in avoiding war, than in preventing proliferation. They seem to be more interested in tying down Gulliver than in helping combat the Lilliputians. And some of them may even see proliferation as a way to tie down U.S. power. Export controls, in the view of the Bush administration, are very, very weak instruments. And there are many cases where bad guys have gotten stuff under the table from other states, including major powers. Containment. That instrument, which worked during the Cold War, doesn't seem to apply very well in the view of the Bush administration in dealing with the new nightmare. I mean, we contained the Soviet Union during the Cold War, and they built tens of thousands of nuclear warheads, and they built the biggest arsenals of chemical and biological weapons known to mankind. So containment is not really the answer in dealing with proliferation. Preventive diplomacy is not viewed in high regard by this administration. It's seen as a weak reed precisely because the rest of the international community is not willing to come on board in the very hardest cases. And multilateral organizations, the role of the United Nations, for example, again, a weak reed. We'll go there if it helps, but we don't expect much from it. So all of these instruments that have been used in the past by prior administrations to deal with their own nuclear nightmares are either denigrated or discounted for the new nuclear nightmare. And what is left is power projection and preemption and preventive war. I think the Bush administration has correctly identified the problem. The core problem facing the United States today, our friends and our allies, and our fellow citizens who are living abroad, is this nexus of proliferation and terrorism. I think the Bush administration is also right insofar as it says that some of the instruments that previous presidents have used for their own nightmares are very weak now. And they're much weaker now than they were during the Cold War. They don't apply themselves. They don't adapt themselves very naturally or easily to the kinds of problems that we now face. So I give the administration high marks for identifying the problem. And I think its analysis is partly correct. But its remedies are extremely narrow. My wife, who is here today and who is a body worker, keeps reminding me about the need for balance. And I think what has happened at present is that we have lost our balance. When you denigrate treaties, norms, multilateral organizations, diplomacy, you're left either with the use of force or proliferation. Those are very stark choices. And when you use force, you are likely to accentuate the problem even when you address an immediate concern. You're likely to accentuate the problem because those folks who might think that they may be next on the receiving line of force are going to accelerate their efforts. They're going to act opportunistically on the assumption that the American public will not repeatedly endorse the use of force. When you do try to deal with this significant problem in a very narrow and unbalanced way, you are going to weaken alliances. You are going to weaken treaties, weaken norms, weaken multilateral organizations. In effect, weaken all the other instruments that have previously been at your disposal to help corral this significant problem. And when you weaken all those other instruments, you are then left once more with the use of force. And the use of force either establishes the conditions for the subsequent use of force or for the acceptance of proliferation. Where does this lead? I think if we continue along this very imbalanced approach, it leads to a war without end and a war without friends. I think that's where it leads. The use of force has to be an option. But our men and women in uniform need other options. The Bush administration is asking our men and women in uniform to place their lives at risk, to go into harm's way, to take away from Saddam and his regime the weapons of mass destruction that are being hidden. At the same time that we are asking our men and women in uniform to face these severe threats, we are also saying to the world that the treaties that are embodied to prevent these threats from occurring are not worth strengthening. These treaties are feckless. They are not worth strengthening. This is a very unbalanced approach. We spend more today on missile defenses than we do on the State Department. That's very unbalanced. For every dollar that we spend on missile defenses, We spend two dimes to try and safeguard dangerous weapons and materials around the world to prevent them from being proliferated. $1 for missile defense, two dimes for safeguarding dangerous materials. We spend five times more on what we call nuclear stockpile stewardship, keeping our nuclear forces, our nuclear weapons, excuse me, ready for use, preparing for a resumption of nuclear testing. We spend five times more on that than we do on safeguarding dangerous materials. We're out of balance. I think we're dangerously out of balance, and we will not find safety in this troubling period until we find our balance. The old debates between hawks and doves really have morphed into debates, domestic debates, between dominators and conciliators, at least in my view. And the dominators believe in the use of force because these other instruments are so weak. Domination is both a strategy and a tactic. Conciliators only have a tactic. They don't have a strategy. And that's a real problem. Because if we're going to find our balance, we need to find a national security strategy that is balanced, that synthesizes the military instruments that we will need in this dangerous world, and as well as all the other instruments that we are now holding in such light regard. I think this is a big challenge for us. Nobody is even articulating what this alternative national security strategy, this alternative to dominance, might look like. We're going to be dominant for as far into the future as the eye can see. Our dominance gives us unprecedented tools, but it also accentuates the problems that we face. So we need an alternative national security strategy. The one that I am inclined to endorse is what I call cooperative threat reduction. We work with major powers. We work with our friends and allies. We use all of the instruments that served us during the Cold War. We understand that they need to be adapted to new circumstances, but we use all of this to address a new set of problems, a new nightmare. We also need to remain very, very strong because there are some countries out there who aim to get dangerous weapons who are not inclined to cooperate with us on threat reduction. So we need instruments to deal with non-cooperative threat reduction. But we need to find a balance. We don't have it. And until we find it, I think the folks who are going to suffer the most are the people who were sent in harm's way in uniform. Thank you very much.
Who would like to begin the discussion? Yes? Mrs. Fernbach?
What do you think is the possibility that people will be able to see that our nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction are more of a liability than an asset? For instance, if these are hit by some kind of bomb from most anywhere. That's it.
During the Cold War, we had these arguments about just how useful nuclear weapons were. And we never really resolved that argument. Some folks felt they were very, very useful. If need be, to fight and win a nuclear war. But short of that, the nuclear balance mattered because one could leverage favorable political outcomes because of advantages in the nuclear balance. Or one could expect unfavorable political outcomes as well as military outcomes if the nuclear balance was adverse. Now, we never sorted that out. The Soviet Union dissolved before we concluded what the answer to that argument was. I think what's most interesting to me is that a lot of the same attitudes have carried over from the Cold War to the current set of circumstances, which is completely different. President Clinton proposed to the Senate that it give its consent to a treaty to completely ban all nuclear weapons testing for all time. Well, that's a real litmus test, this treaty, about how you feel about nuclear weapons, what role they play in your national security. And the country, this was in 1996, so quite a few years after the Cold War ended. And the Senate split pretty much down the middle, with one party against this treaty, another party for this treaty. We've never resolved this argument. I personally believe that the role of nuclear weapons in this new world is certainly much smaller than it was during the Cold War. We want to remind folks who might want to use nuclear weapons against us, whoever they may be, that they could expect a devastating response if they did that, if they tried that. But I'm hard-pressed to see how and under what circumstances we would use nuclear weapons against a third world country, against a terrorist group, against evildoers. Now, the Bush administration has said something with respect to the Iraq War that other administrations have hinted at, and that is that if the United States were attacked by chemical weapons or biological weapons, then we would reserve the right to retaliate with nuclear weapons. And this threat is out there now. I hope that it is not tested, of course. But I think that if the United States did use nuclear weapons, even after such a terrible provocation against a third world country, against an Islamic country, against a vastly weaker country, there would be horrendous ramifications globally, especially in the Islamic world. We say this, however, because we try to deter an adversary from thinking about using chemical weapons or biological weapons. Again, a Cold War concept applied to new circumstances.
Next question. Yes, Ambassador Newsom.
Michael, one instrument that you did not mention, perhaps it's a sub-instrument, is that of inspections. Could you evaluate the value of inspections, whether they work under normal circumstances or only if backed by the threat of force?
Inspections work inversely, in my opinion, to the nature of the problem. In a cooperative treaty arrangement, as we had and as you helped negotiate with the Soviet Union, we developed very intrusive inspection mechanisms. And they worked extremely well. And we went to all these places that we never expected to go. Missile deployment areas, production sites. We went far and wide. And we still do in Russia. Cooperative relationship. Countries like Japan, Germany, that have a significant infrastructure of nuclear power. We inspect. We have international inspectors that go there. And they get their work done without impediment. Trickier situation, Iraq. Let's start with Iran. Iran is going for the complete nuclear fuel cycle. They want nuclear power reactors. They want the ability to reprocess the material that comes out of those reactors, which can be made into bombs. The inspection agency and the rules of the game under the Non-Proliferation Treaty allow that to happen. Perfectly permissible. For a while, the international inspectors were not allowed to go to some of these facilities by the government of Iran. Now, very interestingly and perhaps brazenly, the government of Iran is allowing inspectors to come see that it is putting in place all of the elements to make bombs, and to do so in a fairly rapid manner. This is very troublesome, and inspections really don't help us, in this case, with a cooperative state or a quasi-cooperative state. In the case of Iraq, which is a non-cooperative state, inspections had been going on off and on for more than a decade. The inspectors found what the Iraqis failed to hide. Before the war started, Iraq became somewhat more cooperative, faced with Allied expeditionary forces in excess of 200,000 troops along their periphery. The question that the Bush administration faced was, we can get 6 missiles every other day given up. As long as we keep these forces in the field, how long are we going to keep these forces in the field? The Bush administration's answer in the negotiating endgame was about 72 hours, which was not an answer designed to get a positive outcome short of war. But on the other hand, the French government's answer initially was 4 more months, wait out there in the desert for 4 more months, guys, and then we'll talk about it. And if the inspections are going real well, which we expect them to, you can stay out there longer. Right before the war, the government of France shortened that timeline to 1 month, which was a reasonable timeline had it been presented to the international community earlier. A couple of countries actually did that. Didn't get many takers. But the government of France was still not prepared to authorize the use of force after a date certain. And in my view, the only way to have resolved the situation without the use of force was to present the government of Iraq with a date certain, which the entire international community, more or less, certainly all the major powers, endorsed. France was not prepared to do that. Not clear to me that Germany was prepared to do that, Russia was prepared to do that, China was prepared to do that. Now, the preamble to all this was all bad. There were many misestimates and missteps by the Bush administration. And we have to look those straight, we have to look at that clearly. We got the outcome that we felt was the only outcome that would work. but by denigrating all the other instruments, we are where we are today. This is a very mixed message, and I understand that. But it's how I feel.
Next question. Peyton Wary.
Do you believe the missile defense system is worthwhile or an exercise in futility?
There's more than one missile defense system. Probably there's more than half a dozen. But the way I divide the problem is between theater missile defenses, the missile defenses that go with our troops into troubled neighborhoods. These missile defenses are directed against missiles that don't cross oceans. They are missiles that go much shorter ranges, that are a severe threat to forward deployed forces. They're a severe threat to friends and allies. This is an easier, this is not an easy problem, but it is an easier problem than a missile defense of a large territory, a national missile defense. And we have tried to do that, as you know, for, well, since the 1950s. We've spent in excess of $100 billion on this problem. We don't yet have a system that is reliable. We are rushing to deploy a few missiles, missile defense interceptors, in the state of Alaska. And we're going to try and do this before the other elements of the system are ready, the radars, space-based systems to help cue the interceptor missile to hit a bullet with a bullet. This is a very hard problem, because a missile that is traveling such a long distance can carry with it all kinds of decoys that makes it real hard to figure out where the warhead is and where the confusion is. I think the theater missile defenses are absolutely essential in this day and age, and we're making good progress there. National missile defenses, I view it like I would view any other insurance policy. I'd like to have a catastrophic insurance policy on my house. I'm not going to pay a huge amount for it, but I may need it someday. I think putting some missile defense interceptors in the state of Alaska might be a reasonable insurance policy, but I would like to put in place a system that works or has a hope of working.
Next question, Lee Middleditch.
Given where our country finds itself on Monday, March the 24th, 2003, what are your recommendations for maintaining the balance that you suggest sometime in the future?
Well, it's very hard to find your balance in a war. And we're committed. We have troops in the field that are having a real hard time. And they're likely to have an even harder time in the days and weeks ahead. So we're committed to disarm Saddam Hussein. I think we have to succeed at that. I think this is likely to be a chastening experience. It should not be a chest-thumping experience. And I think after it's over is the time for us to try and regain our balance. Because we have opportunistic cases of proliferation that are happening alongside this war. Iraq is not alone, as the president has said. Iran and North Korea, they've had programs in place before this war started, before this administration came into office. But they have accelerated their efforts in a very opportunistic fashion. And we have to figure out a strategy to deal with these other cases. Otherwise, the nuclear nightmare of 20-odd states can still confront us. But if we do not approach these other cases in a more balanced fashion, which, by the way, will be more difficult as a result of the imbalanced approach that we have taken in this particular case against Iraq, we're in trouble. We're in trouble. I mean, the object of national security policy ought to be, ideally, that you do not present the country with terrible choices, where you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. But I'm afraid we're in that neighborhood now in dealing with these other cases.
Next question. Yes, Penny. Briefly.
Yes, very briefly. One, just out of curiosity, you said that international inspectors go into, well, Russia, Japan, Germany. Do they come and inspect in our country, A? And B, you mentioned that terrorists are going to be able to get a hold of some weapons of mass destruction. And how, I mean, it's one thing to go to war against a country that's a definite entity and, you know, and it's possible. But with terrorists that may get these weapons that are hiding out all over the world, I mean, how do we go after them?
Yes, we do have, we host inspections in our country. We have Russian inspectors at our military bases just as we inspect their military bases. We have foreign inspectors that visit our chemical facilities because we belong to a treaty that outlaws chemical weapons. The easiest place to make chemical weapons are at chemical facilities that produce fertilizer or other domestic products. So international inspectors come to our chemical facilities to look just as they go to facilities elsewhere. Now, the regulations that these inspectors follow need to be strengthened. They're weak. And there have been many miscreants involved in this process of watering down inspections, including our own country. When the United States Senate consented to the ratification of this Chemical Weapons Convention, we did so by attaching two conditions to our approval. One condition was that the President of the United States had the right to reject inspections if he saw fit. So one standard for me and another standard for you. Of course, other people can follow that standard too. The second condition that we attached, our senators attached to this convention, was that nobody, we had the right to prevent inspectors who take samples for diagnosis to internationally approved laboratories. We had the right to say no. No samples leave the United States of America. Now, we're not alone here. There are many other miscreants in watering down this convention. But if we're going to find our balance, we need to hold a mirror in front of ourselves, and we need to put a mirror in front of other folks and say, what are we going to do to strengthen these norms? What are we going to do to strengthen these treaties? This is what I'm going to do. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? This is part of the balancing act that's needed. We have, this has been such a gruesome talk. There is also good news. There's a lot of good news that I need to lay on the table. After the Soviet Union collapsed, the United States began working with the Russian government and with other governments to put in place very creative, cooperative methods to safeguard dangerous weapons and materials. So our nuclear weapons laboratories would go over to the nuclear weapons laboratories in the former Soviet Union and help their fellow scientists to, with their accounting systems, with their control systems, with their safeguards, with locks, with sensors, with perimeter fencing. We are working with the Russian Navy to lock down all of the Russian Navy's nuclear weapons. We are working with foreign governments in quiet ways, not just the former Soviet Union, countries outside of the Soviet Union, to protect against theft, diversion, to protect against terrorists getting their hands on these weapons. We're working with customs services in tens of countries. We are helping countries identify radioactive sources within their borders that maybe they're not even aware of in their entirety, that could be used by terrorist groups to make what we would call dirty bombs. They don't produce a mushroom cloud, but they can create the release of radioactivity, and they can create havoc in a financial center or in a, you know, any major metropolitan area. This work, which is called cooperative threat reduction, sometimes it's called the Nunn-Lugar set of initiatives, is underway. It's underfunded. It's not getting the priority it deserves. But there is this whole new creative endeavor that began after the Cold War ended, which is a real good news story. Now, there are a lot of places you need to lock down, but we are making progress.
What do you think about the comparison between where we used to focus attention, namely policy or statements of Secretary of States when they came to the end of their tenure, that they had succeeded because no nuclear weapon had been fired in anger during their administration. Now, with our focus on troops in the field who are suffering all kinds of terrible experiences with more to come, does that give us any impetus to move in the direction that you suggest we might want to move?
There are so many variables. There are so many unknowns. I think the course of this war can have a powerful effect on how we as an electorate think. We might even be faced with the question of the use of weapons of mass destruction against our troops. How will we react to that as a country? Will the divisions that are now apparent within the electorate about this war? I mean, we are closing ranks, and our thoughts are with the troops in the field and the trials that they must be facing. But this is a very divided country. This is the first time that we have fought a preventive war of this kind. We have elevated preventive war from an option to a core component of our doctrine. How do we feel about that? How sustainable is it? We can go off in many different directions, and we can be very, very divided by this experience, in which case the coalescing around a new, more balanced approach is going to be hard to do. Somebody asked me, Is this new synthesis that's required, a more balanced synthesis, that uses cooperative threat reduction, keeps the use of force as an option? Is that more likely in the event of a quick and very successful war? Or is it more likely in the event of a very prolonged and divisive war? And I'm not sure I know the answer to that question, but it's one that's worth thinking about. My preliminary judgment is that it's more likely if we have a short and successful war, which is one more reason to hope for that result.
Well, that's a note on which I'm afraid we have to close since we've come to our adjournment time. If you're interested in international cooperative threat reduction and the other items in the title of Michael's book, it's not available outside, but it is available through Amazon, and you could get it in that way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.